watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, and thanks for listening in the Mad River Valley on WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, Stolen Elections and Beyond, with Mark Crispin Miller and Paul Kibble.
I never took food from the widows and orphans, and never a hard-working man I oppressed. So take your pace easy.
Mark is a professor of media studies at New York University. He's written articles for The Nation, The New Yorker. He's been on many different national radio and television shows, and we're extremely fortunate to have him here with us today. Please welcome Mark Crispin Miller.
I want to start off by telling you a story. 2 years ago, I got myself invited to a fundraiser for John Kerry when he was just one of many aspirants to the Democratic Party nomination for president. I got myself invited by the New York treasurer of his campaign, who shared my concern about the integrity of the electoral system, precisely, or I should say primarily, because of the use of electronic touchscreen machines. This had been a profound concern of mine and of certain other people's since the passage of the HAVA Act, and this limited network of people were trying to do whatever they could do to get this all-important issue on the national agenda. So I got a little FaceTime with the senator. It was at George Plimpton's house. He came in. I was introduced to him. I looked up at him. He was very tall. He looked down at me. And I had about 5 minutes to try to convey the seriousness and the complexity of this problem to him, and with a sense of urgency. So, you know, I think the cards were stacked against me, because I'm sure I sounded psychotic, you know. And as far as he was concerned, I probably looked psychotic, short but psychotic, because he'd never given this a thought. I don't think he knew about it at all. But he did wear a look of grave concern, nodded, and thanked me for my effort to enlighten him. He's going to take this under advisement, you know. I could almost see my words go, you know, in one ear and out the other. That night I also met Teresa Hines Carey and talked to her about it, and she at least, you know, seemed to get it. She was very exercised about it. But nothing came of this, and we all know what happened. Well, I should say we all think we know what happened then. Concerning that, what we think happened, as you know, I wrote a book about the election of 2004, and I wrote this book to give people a panoramic sense of what went down last year and to try to give people a view of the kind of mentality that drives the anti-democratic crusade. I wrote this book for one reason only, you know, not to challenge the outcome of the last election. There's no constitutional way to do that. I wrote the book to jumpstart a national movement of radical electoral reform. And so, knowing as I did that the mainstream media is not going to take this seriously, I decided I got to get to as many prominent people as possible. So 2 weeks ago, I got myself invited to a fundraiser for John Kerry. political action committee was meeting in New York. They were going to have a dinner, and I was allowed to come in, you know, before the dinner. And in he came, tall as ever. And I got a very different reception from him this time. Okay? I had the book, you know, held aloft, and he looked very interested, and I said, "You were robbed, Senator." And he said, "I know!" Just like that. "I know!" And he started to say, you know, "But, you know, I can't find the evidence. I can't persuade my colleagues to take this seriously." I certainly knew what he was talking about, but he was, you know, really, I have to say, more than refreshing to hear him say this. You know, I was delighted. He said he had just had a big argument the week before with Christopher Dodd of Connecticut, trying to tell Dodd, "Look, these voting machines are really not reliable." And Dodd just got mad, didn't want to hear about it. So Dodd, "We looked into this, there's no story there." He said, "Well, is there evidence in your book?" I said, "Well, yeah, you know, there's really quite a lot of evidence." I told him about the Government Accountability Office report, the GAO report. I see heads nodding. People in here have heard of it. Most people in this country have not, because this groundbreaking report on the flaws and dangers of touchscreen voting by a very, very establishment government body has gone almost completely unreported in this country. In fact, Kerry had not heard about it. He said, "Oh, really? The GAO, really?" So instead of saying to him, "What, is your staff in a coma?" You know, which I wanted to say, you know, that's, you know, you can attract more flies with honey than with vinegar. I didn't say that, you know. I said, "Yeah, GAO report. You can just go right online and get a copy." And he was quite pleased. You know, you could see it was obvious that he was going to use this in his arguments. So I said, "Now, Senator, I believe that in the spirit of your groundbreaking investigations into Iran-Contra and DCCI in the Senate, which I happen to think is his greatest work, in the spirit of those investigations, you should really look into what happened last year, and you should make it a larger inquiry into the state of America's electoral apparatus, because it's in shambles." And I can't remember how I put this. I can only tell you what I was trying to say to him, but I was being tactful, so I don't know what I said. I was trying to say to him, "If you think you're going to get like 10 votes from the people you sold out last time, if you don't embrace this issue with both arms, you don't have a prayer," because I didn't say that either. But I want to say, you know, there's a lot of people who felt disappointed, you know. So he, you know, he nodded. And I mean, now he wasn't just wearing a mask of concern. He was really listening. And he said, "Well, I don't know if I can be the one to do that, because there's a sour grapes factor." I said, "Okay, you know, I understand that. I mean, I'm not the politician. He is. It's easy for me to say, you know, do this, do that." But I said, "You know, read the book. The book is very persuasive." He said, "I will. I'm really excited. I'll read it this weekend. Thanks a lot." Punched me on the arm, and he gave me a thumbs up, threw me a football, you know. And I caught the football, and we roughhoused a little bit, you know. The memory is very precious to me. So anyway, I was really happy. I thought this was a great thing. It didn't occur to me that this was news exactly, but I did tell my friends, I emailed people, you know, Kerry thinks the race was stolen. And then my book tour started on Tuesday, a couple of weeks ago, in New York. And I found that, you know, telling that story really, really went over. I mean, it really made people feel optimistic. So then I was on Democracy Now! Last Friday. Did any of you hear that? Okay. And I was debating Mark Hertzgaard, who's got this piece in the latest Mother Jones, seeking to throw cold water on the wild theory that the Republicans stole the election last year. And one of the things that struck me in his arguments, and he's a friend of mine, okay, I've known him for a long time. I don't think this is his best work, okay? One of the things that struck me was he seemed to me to be unduly swayed by the say-so of Democrats. So we were talking about Warren County, you know, how they declared a terrorist alert throughout the press before the vote count. And his claim was, "Well, I talked to a Democrat who was there." And he said, "Gee, I wish I could tell you that it was suspicious, but, you know, frankly, there's nothing to it." You know, oh, okay. It turned out the next day, according to the FBI, there was no terrorist alert, And then the Cincinnati Enquirer reported that this plan had been in the works for 9 days. So I don't care what a Democrat told him. Who is this Democrat? Who cares? Why does that trump common sense? You know, I didn't say any of this. But I says to myself, well, I mean, if he wants to trot out Democratic authorities, I got a great response. So I said, you know, well, as a matter of fact, Kerry thinks the race was stolen. And I told the story. And Mark was very impressed. Yeah, wow, this is big news. You really buried the lead. He should call a press conference. This is important. Well, in fact, that day, Democracy Now! Sent out a press release breaking, you know, Kerry believes the race was stolen. So there was a lot of stuff on the internet. It was all over the place. And, you know, sites like Democratic Underground had long threads about it. And Raw Story, the new website in D.C., called Kerry's office to get a response. And a staffer of Kerry's gave them a statement that categorically denied that he had ever had this conversation with me. The only true thing in Mr. Miller's account is that he gave the senator the book, you know, like a process server. And I went up to him and I sort of pressed it on his arm and I ran away. You're served, you know. This was really, and most galling to me personally was the fact that they implied that I'd made this up to sell the book. I said, we know Mr. Miller's trying to sell a book. So I gave Ross Story my own response. Then the next day, Robert Perry, great reporter who has the website Consortium News, ran a piece based on what he was told by a guy named Jonathan Weiner, W-I-N-E-R, who's an old Kerry associate, who said to Perry, yeah, John thinks the race was stolen. He said that to me, too. So, you know, I wasn't making it up. I don't make things up. In this world, these days, you don't have to make things up. You know what I mean? You can't. It's impossible to keep track of reality. I tell this story, you know, to make a few larger points. It's not really about Kerry per se, and it's not about my personal peak at having been, you know, treated so disrespectfully. This is not a personal issue, and it's not even a partisan issue. It is a civic issue. It's a civic issue of profound importance. And I tell the story about Kerry partly to make clear that this is not a left versus right or Democrat versus Republican issue. In fact, on this issue, it's really the people at risk because of the collusion of the two parties. I think the collusion is passive. I mean, people have said to me, no, they made a deal. But I think that's unlikely. And if somebody has evidence, I'll look at the evidence. But I don't think it's necessary for there to be a deal, because this has happened before. When you have a resolved, well-organized, highly disciplined, fascistic movement of some kind, right? Let's hear it for fascism. Calm yourselves. And they have a tremendous amount of social power and media influence, and they manage to get the press on their side for various reasons. Those who would resist this, but who aren't all that zealous about it, are simply going to deny there's a problem. Now, why do the Democrats refuse to face this issue? Does it make any sense? Their existence as a party is threatened. They will cease to be if this Republican Party, you know, the Bushevik Party, the theocratic Republican Party, has its way, there will be no more Democrats. Now, one of the reasons why Democrats refuse to look at this or read the evidence or listen to it is just corruption, because a lot of Democrats are, in effect, Republicans. And in places like Ohio, rural Ohio, maybe you've had Bob Petraeus come here and speak, or you read his stuff is great. You know, as he explained to me, and as he says in his writing, the Democrats in rural Ohio are, you know, just as much a part of the status quo as the Republicans. They're very close to the Republicans, and they all serve at the pleasure of Ken Blackwell. So they all toe the line. There was only one Board of Election member, a Democrat in the state, who blew the whistle, and that was Cheryl Eaton, who, okay, not necessary. We love Cheryl, and, you know, she exposed the deliberate subversion of the recount that was supposed to take place, and it never has taken place, you know, and there's still 100,000 plus votes in that state that haven't been counted to this day, okay? She's the exception. So a lot of Democrats just go along to get along, and they figure, hey, you know, the two parties, we've divided the spoils, we've worked something out, this is our turf, sharks and the jets, you know, we got to divide it up. So, you know, why upset the apple cart? I think there's a lot of that. But aside from that, it's just plain old denial. Kerry was describing denial to me. Dodd wouldn't have gotten angry if this thought did not frighten him. Frightened of this. Because the implications of what happened last year are quite frightening. Quite frightening. Doesn't make any difference how brilliant a campaign you run. Doesn't make any difference how smart your TV ads are. It doesn't make any difference what a stellar profile your candidate has. You could run Jesus Christ for president, okay? You're not going to win. You're not going to win because this is not a functioning democracy, right? America is no longer a democracy. The last three elections have been stolen. This refusal to confront the implications of what's going down, it has to do with, you know, deeply rooted ideological assumptions that we all have, like it can't happen here. Right? That's a very important. This is the city on a hill. This nation was sort of proclaimed by God, and what has happened to other countries can't happen here. Can't happen here. So, however copious and solid the evidence you have that it has happened here, you can't get anywhere. It's fascinating. You've got a moment at which pretty much everyone now finally agrees that the Bush regime lied or deluded itself and the rest of us to get us into a major war that we're losing. That's really not a good thing. And people will face that. The press will say, yes, that seems to be true. You got a moment in which people will say, yes, they did deliberately conspire to out a CIA agent who was responsible for keeping us safe from weapons of mass destruction, and they did it for petty political reasons. You know, the people struggling to deny this are having an ever harder time, right? We accept this. We accept that they had to know that an attack was coming on 9/11, and they, at best, did nothing about it. We also accept that in the face of one of the worst natural disasters in our modern history, you know, they did nothing, and they continued to do nothing. All this we accept, right? All this we accept. All this, the press will, yeah, that's true. Okay, progressives, everybody snarling, foaming at the mouth, the Bushes, ooh, they're terrible. But somehow, there's this magic circle drawn around the election. Oh, no, they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't do that. Well, that's what they would do first of all. In fact, that's what they did do. That's why they're here, right? Now, understand this. Can't happen here. I want to try to give you some sense of what I believe we're really up against. Because I think it's only if we face that we'll be able to deal with it. So, okay, here I wrote this book. It's about the election. The electoral system is a mess. I think there are certain policies that we should all pursue to improve the system, and we can talk about those policies. I mean, I'll just give you a foretaste, because I know often people want to hear that because these are take-home points. So take-home points. We should go back to paper ballots. We should ban the participation of all private vendors in our electoral system. Using proprietary software to count votes is like having a secret vote count. Okay, so this is completely unacceptable. Anyone who defends this is a foe of American democracy. Okay, it's as simple as that. We also need a uniform federal standard for our elections from coast to coast, county to county, precinct to precinct. We have to have I'm going to say the dirty B word. We have to have an efficient, utterly nonpartisan bureaucracy, you know, sort of on the order of the post office, which just delivers mail, or should, you know, oversee our elections. That's necessary, because what we have now is a shambles. You know, it's this ramshackle mess that is completely taken over by local politicos and bigots and so on. We should make it illegal for secretaries of state to double up as chairs of presidential campaigns. I mean, we call these no-brainers, don't we? We should make voting day a Sunday, if not a whole week. We should have same-day registration. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. But understand me. I didn't come here to tell you all this, okay? Any policy wonk with a little fire can tell you that this is what we need. This is not primarily what we need. Primarily what we need is to, A, recognize the threat that faces us now, and B, reacquaint ourselves with our revolutionary tradition. It's not enough to say we got to have these policies. This is not a policy matter. This is an ideological matter. This is about American democratic freedom. This is about our rights as Americans under the Constitution. This is about the Bill of Rights. This is about the Atlantic revolutionary tradition. This is about the works of Tom Paine and Thomas Jefferson. That's what this is about. Our democracy is not based on elections. Saddam Hussein had elections. Stalin had a constitution. It's not elections that make a democracy. It's popular control of the electoral process. See? It can't happen here. Now let's just traipse back through history a little bit, okay? Did the framers think it can't happen here? Well, but where did this idea come from? It certainly didn't come from them. They understood perfectly that it could always happen here. That's why they designed the system as they did, with checks and balances, with a free and independent press. They understood from their vast grasp of history that power always poses a threat to Republican freedom, always. The price of freedom, Jefferson said, is eternal vigilance. Now, he didn't say the price of freedom is vigilance for 60 years, and then we can relax. Now, you know, this kind of discourse, I think a lot of people on the left long ago, you know, made them queasy, because the right wing was always saying things like that. Price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Moderation in defense of freedom is no virtue. This is, you know, Goldwater speak. Well, you know, that's fine. That's true. I think the right wing had it half right. See? And I will add that I would rather have, as an ally in this fight, any authentic conservative who believes in the Bill of Rights way before I'll accept the half-hearted support of an Al Franken or somebody like that, or Mother Jones. You know, the people now, this is us, not the Democratic Party, it's not the media, the people have got to fight back. We're at that point. And in order to do that, we have to make common cause with a lot of people we don't ordinarily talk to. The Bush administration and the movement that it represents is only one part of the Republican Party. The Republican Party is divided now. A lot of Republicans voted against Bush or just stayed home. Okay, and then fooled again. I got a lot of examples of very prominent Republicans of all kinds who came out publicly against Bush before the election. Press would never report on this trend, which was remarkable. But you had Bob Barr of Georgia. You know, can't get much more right-wing than that. You had John Eisenhower. You had General Tony McPeak of the Air Force, who was a pro-Bush military guy in 2000, now coming out for Kerry. You had Tom Clancy. You had Lee Iacocca. You had an open letter signed by 169 tenured and emeritus business professors deploring Bush's economic policies. And the letter started at the Harvard Business School. Remember who went there? Bipartisan groups of diplomats, military men, moderate Republicans. A guy who ran a chapter of Republicans Abroad said he could not in good conscience support Bush. I mean, this guy didn't win the election because very few people really voted for him. Just read my book if you don't believe me. Okay. The thing is that it can happen here, and they knew it. And if we don't reacquaint ourselves with their concerns, it will happen here and have happened here for good. Because this is what we're up against, okay? We're not up against conservatism. Bush is not a conservative president. Cheney is not a conservative vice president. The movement that we're fighting is not a conservative movement. That's why they didn't get all those Republican votes. Conservatives, you know, I'm not a conservative. But I respect conservatism. I see it as a coherent philosophy. I see it essentially as a philosophy that's based on the improvement, or at least the maintenance, of this world. See? So they believe in limited government, fiscal prudence, you know, no foreign wars, all that kind of stuff. I can live with all that, you know. What does that have in common with this regime and its agenda? This is a guy who, with his tax cuts, has spent more money than all our previous presidents combined. Did you know this? He has vastly expanded the police powers of the federal government. Vastly expanded them. He has repealed habeas corpus. I mean, if on his say-so, you're a terrorist, they can come and drag you off to prison, and they don't have to tell anybody that they did it. This is called disappearing people. This is unprecedented in our history. Okay? We don't have freedom of assembly. We have First Amendment zones. Freedom of speech has been radically abridged. I mean, you know all that I'm saying, right? This is not conservatism. It's extremely radical. It's much closer to fascism. Okay? It has a great deal to do with the power of corporations. You can hiss all you want, but they're not going to listen. You know, the fact that end corporate personhood is involved in this event is you know, really something that makes me very happy, because the in a sense, the idea that corporations should have the rights of persons or the status of persons, you could regard it, in a sense, as the worm in the apple here. I mean, things really started to go wrong in this country when corporations took on such power. And indeed, as we've seen from the dangerous sway of the corporate manufacturers of touchscreen voting machines, corporations are wreaking havoc on American democracy, because corporations are driven by a concern for only one thing, and that's their own profits. That's money. Money over the franchise. Money over votes. This is something I think we can all agree on. But we have to take a step further, because there's something else at work here. It's not just corporations. It's not just the drive for profit. It's not just corporate capitalism. As a matter of fact, certain large sectors of the corporate system are extremely unhappy with this president. Like the insurance industry has done a big about-face on global warming. Well, for rational reasons. Because they don't want to go bankrupt. Right? This is a threat to... So this is rational self-interest at work. And you know, you read accounts of the financial get-togethers at Davos, Switzerland. It's like a wake there now. They're just miserable. Because this guy, this cabal, this movement, is destroying the economy. They're on a suicide course. So even though they are infinitely pleasing to many corporate interests, you know, Halliburton and so on, especially their cronies, they are on a suicide course. They have an apocalyptic streak that cannot be explained in economistic terms. Now, people on the left tend to explain everything in economistic terms. It's always about the money, follow the money. That's true to a great degree, but it's not enough, because it does not account for the ferocious strain of anti-enlightenment activism that this regime represents. Okay? Understand that this is a theocratic movement. It is not just a bunch of corporations that know better slyly manipulating the pieties of the masses. That is a leftist fallacy, because we're talking about the energetic political participation of a number of extremely right-wing billionaires with enormous clout, people like Richard Mellon Scaife and Howard Amundson. These are people who are extraordinarily active and productive on the political front. They make George Soros look like a piker. They spend far more money than he does. They spend it on propaganda. They spend it on political issues. Howard Amundson is the motive force behind the schism in the Episcopalian Church. He supports the Discovery Institute, which is behind the spread of intelligent design. So to say there's religion over here and there's corporations over here is a mistake. It's not that simple, because there are points of convergence. What we have here is a movement intent on turning the United States into a Christian republic. Okay? Now, they often say the United States is a Christian republic. And when you say to them, well, as a matter of fact, it isn't. I mean, look at, say, the First Amendment. Look at Article 6, which forbids religious tests for office holders. look at everything the framers ever said on the subject. Well, they don't want to hear that, so they say, well, it's a Christian republic. Does this sound familiar? Mr. President, there's no evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Oh, yeah? There is, too. Go back and find it. Oh, wait. Oh, here it is. Here it is. Okay? See, we think, oh, they're lying through their teeth. But please believe me when I say that there's some evidence that Cheney really still believes there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. If it were only lying, if it were only Machiavellian manipulation, I promise you we would be better off than we are now. What we're dealing with is pathological. You know, you tell them, hey, there's no evidence for intelligent design. They say, yes, there is. They proclaim that there is. Well, there's no evidence that abstinence-based sex education does anything except raise pregnancy rates and raise rates of sexually transmitted disease. They say, no, that's not, no, because it's faith-based. They live in a faith-based universe. Now, I want you to grasp the enormity of this problem. We've all grown up in the shadow of the Cold War. All our politics were forged in the context of a post-Enlightenment moment. I mean, the Enlightenment settled, okay, and now we have a clash between two great Enlightenment doctrines, capitalism and socialism. Well, you know something? That turned out to be a blip on the radar screen. We are right back where we were when the framers wrote the Constitution. We are right back there. They did this incredibly brave and intelligent thing. They forged a national charter that was the first in human history not to invoke a deity. They separated church from state. And this was not a plot by a handful of, you know, professorial smarty pantses who were a lot less religious than the average Joe. This was, on the one hand, an innovation by brilliant deists who were indeed rationalists, but it wasn't just that. Separation of church and state grew out of American soil because this was a nation of religious immigrants, and most believing Americans were grateful for the separation of church and state. You know that the Baptists for over 100 years were ardent Jeffersonians because they understood that if there's a state church in this country, it'll be an Episcopalian church and they'll be persecuted again. So it was in everybody's interest to separate church from state. There is no reason to apologize for it. There's no reason to dance away from it. There's no reason to meet with Hillary and decide, how can we look more religious? Screw that. When de Tocqueville came here in the 1830s, he remarked on the fact that the United States was the most religious country on earth. And he understood the reason is because they separate church and state. There's no coercion here, so religion thrives. Why can't Democrats just say that? What's wrong with that? Is there a problem? Now, the fact that they don't seem to have any faith in our revolutionary traditions, they don't seem to have any understanding of what the framers wrote, they don't really believe in American democracy, leaves us extremely vulnerable to a highly organized extremist movement that is intent on undoing all of that. We don't hear about it, right? Like this business with the Supreme Court, we hear about, you know, Alito's style, you know, his style, what kind of a person he is. We parse his record and talk about his demeanor and what kind of suit he wears and his life experiences and so on. Maybe if we get really bold and specific, we'll say, you know, they're going to repeal Roe v. Wade. Yeah, nobody talks about the fact that Roe v. Wade is like step one for these people, right? It's step one. Do you know what the Constitution Restoration Act is? Few of you do. Go home and do a Google search on it, okay? The Constitution Restoration Act would declare that God is the sovereign basis of American law. Do you know what that means? That means that a judge could make decisions on the basis of the Old Testament and he couldn't be reversed. So if you want a vision of the possible future as these people imagine it, go home and read the book of Leviticus. See how many things you can be executed for doing. Heresy, for example. Astrology. Premarital sex. Well, only the woman gets killed for premarital sex. This is directly and ferociously opposed to the whole American tradition. So when I said this is not a partisan issue, I really meant it. The American people don't go for this. I promise you. A lot of Americans may have been hoodwinked by Bush and so on, but understand that his strong support is now at 22%. With a margin of error of 4 points, so it could be 18%. And 18% is the same proportion of Americans who applauded how Bush and his Congress dealt with Terri Schiavo's case. See? Now, it looks as if, gee, they won the election. Bush got 11.5 million more votes this time than he got in 2000. How he did that, I can't imagine. But he did it. He did it. He pulled it out. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. Praise God. And then all of a sudden, it all collapses. All of a sudden, overnight, everybody hates him. Isn't that mysterious? Well, no, it's not mysterious. They didn't win the election. Okay? I estimate that at least Kerry won by 51% to 48%. Kerry won. And probably by more, or would have. Because between the votes that were thrown away and the votes that were preempted and the votes abroad, it's a significant number. The American people, you know, for all of their or all of our shortcomings, you know, for all of the decadence that has been spawned by a consumer culture, which has had a seriously destructive effect on our ability to function in a democracy, for all that, the American people are not extremists. The American people are not theocrats. There's Wall Street Journal just a few days ago ran a piece about the new phenomenon of evangelical churches trying to do something about global warming through their churches. So it's time for us to join hands with each other, you know? All rational Americans who love our traditions got to join hands and insist on electoral reform, which both parties seem not to want. Right? It's not up to the Democrats. Certainly not up to the media. It's up to us. We have to get back to that. You know why? Because we don't have any choice. There's no choice. If we don't get electoral reform in place, if we don't reclaim the system from the right, this experiment's over. And if this experiment's over, the world could well be over. I think we should return to the best that our framers had to offer and consider ourselves as noble and dedicated representatives of that tradition. We got nothing to apologize for and everything to gain. Thank you.
You're listening to NYU Professor Mark Crispin Miller speaking earlier this month in Portland, Oregon. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, or WMRW Warren. We continue with Mark Crispin Miller, author of Fooled Again.
Before I take a question, I want to make a point. We can't go at this thing with a particular solution uppermost in mind. That's putting the cart before the horse. We have to go into this with the primary goal of making sure that the story of what happened last year gets told. That has to happen. If that doesn't happen, nothing else will happen. There has never been a reform movement that did not follow a scandal. Now, in this case, the scandal's been buried. So what you should all be doing is, you know, model yourselves on Russia's ditto heads to this extent. Whenever you hear a reporter, read a columnist, see a politician talking about the elections in some way, be absolutely relentless. Write to them, call them, email them, fax them, pester the hell out of them. Do not let them rest. We have to push this issue onto the national radar screen, and we can only do it by pressuring those with access to the pulpit. See? That story has to be told, because if it ain't broke, nobody's going to want to fix it. See, so what we know in here and what most people know are very different. I have no doubt that most people will grant that the election was stolen once you just tell them a little bit of the evidence. So what I'm saying is, you get enough people upset enough about what really happened, solutions will arise, and they'll be much easier to carry than if we go out into the world and say, we have to do this. People are going to say, why? Why? Wasn't the election legitimate? That's what they said in Mother Jones. Okay, yes. The question is, can I speak about the election last week on Tuesday, and specifically about the election reform measures in Ohio? Last Tuesday was very interesting because there were a lot of victories for the Democrats, and Arnold Schwarzenegger's referendums went down in flames, and that's always a good thing. But, you know, there is cause for serious concern because of what happened in Ohio. Now, the governorships of Virginia and New Jersey, I don't think are that strategically important to the Bush Republicans. However, Ohio is extremely important to the Bush Republicans. According to the polls, and I get this all from Bob Fitrakis, you know, there was every rational expectation of a resounding victory for these reform measures, like 60% support. And that's the proportion by which they lost. Now, these are the same... Think about this. Try to wrap your mind around this. This whole set of measures was proposed in response to what happened in Ohio last year. They used the same machinery to vote on those measures, and those measures fail. Now, you know, it's a feature of the kind of mental illness that afflicts mainstream reporters that they, you know, their memories just go clear after this happens. Oh, well, it lost. So that was bad. That was a very bad thing. And it's just, you know, for those of us who understand what's going on, that should, you know, sting us into redoubled efforts to make sure that kind of stuff doesn't happen again. You know, Ken Blackwell is like this with the religious right in Ohio. I mean, he's their boy. You know, it's rightist pastors who are his shock troops and everything. He has a real theocratic agenda. So we got to keep hammering at all this stuff. Yeah. I thought you were asking me what should the Kerry machine have done that it didn't do. Okay, let's do the first one first. The Democratic Party has been remarkably obtuse about, for example, the problem with touchscreen voting machines. All along. So to a certain extent, I suppose there's nothing much the Kerry machine could have done, because having acquiesced in the spread of these machines, they were powerless to do anything about the way they were misused or used, depending on your point of view. You know, Terry McAuliffe would never address this issue. Never. Big fundraiser for the Democrats, right? Never addressed the issue. The Democrats allowed themselves to be sort of outmaneuvered by Bush and company right at the beginning of his first term. They already had you know, wimped out on the problem, on the fact that Gore had the race stolen from him. The most the Democrats could bring themselves to do to keep on registering their unhappiness with that is not to say, you know, we're digging in our heels here. We're, you know, there's no clear evidence that Bush was elected and et cetera. Instead of doing that, they said, electoral reform, we need electoral reform, we need electoral reform. So Bush and his people, this is all in the book, very deftly started talking about electoral reform. They seized electoral reform, and they used electoral reform as their issue. And then with their issue, they passed the Help America Vote Act. The Help America Vote Act mandates that voting machinery be easily usable by the disabled, and it provides tons of money for touchscreen voting machines. It doesn't mandate the use of the machines. It's slyer than that. It mandates the use of machines the disabled can use and provides tons of cash to states to buy these bogus machines, you see. But, you know, the Democrats, never having been sufficiently on guard, never having been sufficiently suspicious, never having been, I mean, you know, maybe I'm just an old-fashioned guy, but if I had been involved in the parties at the national level back then, I would have thrown in my lot with the people of Florida. And I said, I don't care if you ridicule us and if you deride us and you call us names. If anyone's disenfranchised in this country, everyone is disenfranchised in this country. That's not a racial issue, you know. Right? So, you know, in a way, it was an impossible situation. Now, your second question was, afterwards, what could Kerry do aside from back away from it? Okay, you know, maybe this sounds madcap. I think realistically, his only hope for political salvation lies in his embracing electoral reform. His only hope, because look, here's what the guy did. He reported for duty, right? And then he promised to count every vote, right? And they didn't count any votes, and he went AWOL. A lot of people are mad at him about that. But if he were to say, you know, okay, I lost, I conceded. I never would have believed that Americans could do this. I never would have believed that my political adversaries could stoop to this. I didn't want to believe it. I think, you know, pile on the rhetoric. But I've been studying this issue now for months, and I've come to the sad and horrifying conclusion that this race was illegitimate. And it has nothing to do with my political fortunes. Nobody will believe me if he says that, but he should say that. It's about the American way. You know, I fought for it in Vietnam. But, there, you know, we're all obligated to put our lives on the line for democracy. You understand this? This is not just a thing for troops to do. You know, we have to protect it. I'm writing a speech for him. See, I think he could do it. And I think if he did it, I reckon everybody would come around. They wouldn't necessarily love the guy, but they'd come around. I will certainly go to the mat for him. Anyone who picks up on this issue, anyone who tries to make voting democratic and transparent and fair, they got my support. You know? Who will that be? I have no idea. Will any of them do it? Will Al Gore perhaps do it? It's possible. Edwards? Possible. Well, you know, in the book, I got a story about that, right? That I talked to a relative of Edwards's who was with him when he got the call from Kerry on the cell phone saying, I'm going to concede. Edwards was furious. And, well, he'd been on TV 4 hours before saying we're going to count every vote. So it felt like he's going to look stupid, I mean, at the very least. So he said, you know, it's too soon. You know, it's just one day. You got to wait. There's more votes yet to count. And Kerry said, well, no, you know, he was up in Martha's Vineyard. It gets worse and worse. And he was surrounded by his, Bob Schrum, Mary Beth Cahill. These are his geniuses that have been losing elections for years. I don't know why he hired them. They're Kennedy people, the Ted Kennedy people. And I don't understand it. I don't know why they still get work, you know. But he said, now they're telling me here that if I don't concede, they're going to call us sore losers. Oh, geez, I didn't know. Now that you've explained it, okay, you better concede. You know, it's better that the country should go fascist than that you should get called a sore loser, don't you think? So Edwards says, so what? You know? Which, right? I mean, so they're going to call you a name. That's probably the nicest name they're going to call him, in any case. So that just shows you where he is at. That's right. He says that the issue is the media. The media is all important, but people simply don't know. There's a myth. Now, the common wisdom is anyone who thinks it was stolen is just guessing, is speculating. There's no evidence. All the evidence has been shot down. This is completely false. I don't know how else, and I don't know what there is about the evidence that they claim to find suspicious, but it is a flood tide of evidence. It's the journalistic equivalent of big nuggets of gold lying in the street to be picked up, put in a big sack, you know? Here's an example, and I wanted to bring this up when Beth was talking. Oregon, okay. Let's just leave aside for the moment the proprietary software. You guys know about Nathan Sproul, right? Sproul and Associates. All right, there's a lot of stuff in the book about this. This is just one example. And it happened here and in like seven other states. Nathan Sproul was head of the Arizona Christian Coalition, okay? Then he was head of the Arizona Republican Party. He was instrumental in getting the getting the Christian right politically involved in the early 90s, and he formed a company called Sproul and Associates that was used extensively by the Republicans in the last election. And this is what they did. They posed as liberal opinion pollsters. They'd hang around in front of the MVA or on campuses, and they'd say, well, gee, would you like to sign a petition to stop spousal abuse or something like that? And they get people involved in conversations, try to figure out what party they belong to. They followed a script. Republicans, sign them up, register them. The purpose of Sproul and Associates was to register as many Republicans as possible. Democrats get registered, throw them away. Or alter them. Just make them Republican. Now, whether they were told to do that or whether people figured, well, I'm getting paid to make them Republicans, so I'll just make them, doesn't make any difference. The thing was totally illegal. They also claimed to be working under the aegis of ACT, Americans Coming Together. So it was copyright infringement. Very, very criminal behavior. It happened in Oregon. Tons of schools here in Oregon. It was covered in some of your newspapers. It happened in Nevada. It happened in New Mexico. It happened in West Virginia. It happened in Pennsylvania. It happened in Ohio. Okay? Now, this was covered in some local newspapers before the election. Farhad Manju of Ceylon wrote a good piece about it before the election. And the election came, nothing. All over. Who? Nathan what? What happened? No, that election was fine. It was great. At the end of the day, it was fair. At the end of the day, it was legitimate. Case closed. All right, so I looked into it, put it all together. It was a big, big deal. And I found out that Nathan Sproul and Associates actually was the Republican National Committee's eighth largest campaign expense. Now, what the news had been that, you know, the GOP spent like $3.5 million on Sproul and Associates. I found out they spent over $8 million. And I found out that when they filed their, you know, statement of how they spent their money with the Federal Election Commission, they hid over half the expenditures by saying 2005. You know, they spent money on lodgings and travel in 2005. How they did that in 2004 is an interesting question. This was, they were laundering money like crazy in Ohio. It's extremely costly to steal an election. Remember Nixon? Remember the $1 million? We can get that. You have to have, shopping bags filled with laundered cash that you hand out to goons who go around intimidating voters. It's clearly what happened here. Okay? Your attorney general is the only one in the country that has investigated this, and I don't know what the status of it is, but if he's listening, or if anyone knows him or his people, get on this, because this is one of those threads from the shirt. You pull the thread and the shirt collapses. This is very important. See, because CoinGate in Ohio, which is a story our media won't touch, is all about how they laundered millions and millions of dollars to spend on stealing the election. Now, clearly, they were spending money on Sproul and Associates, money that they don't want people to know they spent. And Sproul was a special guest at President Bush's Christmas party in December of 2004. It reeks. Okay? Can anybody tell me that this is A, not evidence of crime, and B, of no interest to the public? It's of tremendous interest to the public, you know? So I can't repeat myself often enough on this score. We have to get the story out there. And it's not just the voting machines. It's every conceivable method and tactic of disenfranchisement imaginable was used to pull off this enormous crusade against the electorate. Yeah. Do I think that Kerry was physically threatened? Or did he find a horse's head in his bed, right? All I can say is that the thought did cross my mind. I doubt it. I think Kerry, just given who he is and, you know, the wing of the party he comes from, it wasn't necessary. I find myself wondering why Michael Moore has been so silent on this. Michael Moore insists the election was legitimate. And Michael Moore's not a guy who would do that, you know? So I thought, yeah, maybe they said, gee, the lovely little girl you have, it would be a shame if something happened to her, you know, that kind of thing. So I don't know. I would put nothing past them, right? I mean, can I say with perfect confidence that I don't think they had Wellstone whacked? I can't. I mean, maybe it was just an accident, but you'd have to be naive to think that he's the only progressive in the Senate, and they wanted Minnesota. Oh, let me add another point. This book is not just about the White House. It's about the Senate and the House as well. Because in all those states last year where there were Senate seats, up for consideration, there were these surprising victories by Republicans. And as I explained and fooled again in 2002, in Minnesota, Colorado, and especially Georgia, all three states, Diebold was heavily involved in the race, and in all three states, there was a surprising come-from-behind victory for the Republican. And in all three states, the Republican is a theocrat. So they don't deserve their Senate majority, they don't deserve their House majority, and they don't deserve the presidency. And now here they are filling up the Supreme Court. Was there a movement to impound the machines in Ohio? There might have been an attempt to get them impounded. Ohio is completely run by a criminal. It's like going into Al Capone, Chicago, and saying, how come you guys didn't impound all those stills? It's a police state there. Well, black box voting got involved in some counties and did seize some stuff. I mean, I don't know how much of that is righteous and how much of that is, you know, a good story, because I haven't seen anything yet, so I don't really know what to think. Now, yes. What, in Ohio? This was the triad man, not the Devo. Yeah. So you're saying my title is unduly harsh. Well, you know, it's an allusion to that famous Bushism, right? When he tried to say, fool me once. And then he ended up quoting The Who, you know? Won't get fooled again. By the way, you know, as long as we're on that subject, I don't think that was stupidity. I mean, people play that for laughs. Michael Moore played that for laughs. But understand that when Bush's English breaks down, it's always because he can't bring himself to say the thing he's being asked to say. He was going to have to say, shame on me. The last thing in the world this guy could ever say is shame on me. He could see it. He could see it coming. You look at the footage. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me, can't get fooled again. Yes. Okay, what can the average person do about this, right? Well, first of all, I'm not entirely sure I know what an average person is. Okay? I mean, I'm an average person. You're an average guy, aren't you? Want to go out and throw the old pill around, you know? I mean, you know, a lot of us have the notion, I think more people get it than you would think from watching the TV news. Right, that's true. And you know, the only way to feel less powerless is to join with others who feel the same way you do. And the first step toward doing that is recognizing that you're not the only one who feels this way. You know, since Bush was first elected, everybody who was opposed to him has felt, well, I'm the only one who's opposed to him. He's a popular president. This guy's never been popular. Never. 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 He had high approval ratings after 9/11. That wasn't popularity. That was fear. Okay? So he's a fear president. This is a fear president. You know, he had his Reichstag fire, and then everybody, you know, oh, save us. You know, that's not popularity. So the thing is that, I mean, not everybody's built to do the same stuff. I find it extremely useful, in fact, essential, to just keep talking, right? Write letters. You know, all these poor nudniks who believe Rush Limbaugh, right? These people are really losers. They're the ones who are getting screwed the worst by the Bush administration. And so they participate in this vicarious ass-kicking that Rush administers to everybody else, and it makes them feel potent. But one thing you can say for them, as for any domestic fascist operation, is that their energies have been mobilized so that they pounce on the telephone or they pounce to the keyboard when they're annoyed by something, you know, when it strikes them as politically incorrect. And because of that, they have wielded enormous influence. You know, they've really cowed the press. Well, it's time for us to do that, too. You know, don't be shy about that. Cancel your subscription. Go after their advertisers. Let them have it, I say. You know, because they're putting us all at grave risk. And I think people know that. I do. I think they know it. Yeah. That's right. Right. Let me add something to that. If you look at the system as a whole, if you look at all of its turrets and its battlements and its concertina wire and its guards and its guns and its loudspeakers and its media outlets, you're just going to want to lie down and die. But that thing is so big, I can't move that. It's just me. It'll crush me like a bug, right? You don't look at it that way. You don't look at it that way. You don't marvel at the thing en masse. You say to yourself, this big thing is resting on a foundation of history. I mean, ongoing history, life, as it changes day after day, as people change. It's based on mass acquiescence. However powerful it is, it cannot persist without mass acquiescence.